Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. Meow, meow. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM Community Radio.
KBOO Community Radio couldn't do it without you. Support KBOO by becoming a member during our Wake Up the Neighborhood Fall Membership Drive, taking place now through September 21st. Your contribution goes towards grassroots community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give. Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
I love you, KBOO.
Despite repeated warnings of dangers up ahead, the captain won't be listening to what's being said. He feels that there's a good chance that we have been misled, and so the captain's.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour, coming at you from KBOO Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I'll be your host for the next hour of views and interviews from the ground up. The music you are listening to is Paul McCartney's song, Despite Repeated Warnings. First off, I want to remind you that KBOO is not your ordinary radio station. It's do-it-yourself radio. Dozens and dozens of volunteers bringing you news and music and commentary from every corner of our community. And it's listeners like you that make it possible. Please help us reach our $30,000 goal for our fall fund drive. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by sending a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. KBOO thanks you. This morning on The Mole, we're going to talk about the fallacy of looking to the market to fix our carbon emission problem. I'll be speaking with economist Marty Hart-Landsberg about what could actually work to avert climate catastrophe. We'll follow that with a discussion about fossil fuel industry attempts to sabotage Oregon's efforts to reduce carbon emissions. Jan Hawkins speaks with climate activist Diana Meisenhelter about Oregon's DEQ rulemaking for the Climate Protection Program and the critical need for the public to weigh in now. We're going to start off the hour with a look at the recent ruling of the International Court of Justice that Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories is, in fact, a violation of international law. In their Left in the Law segment, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discuss the ruling and how it might affect the global movement for justice for Palestinians.
Legal consequences arising from the policies and practices of Israel in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem. Well, Mike, that's the name of the landmark decision on July 19th by the International Court of Justice. The court declares that Israel's occupation of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, is unlawful. So can you summarize this opinion and what makes it declared a landmark decision, as many officials claim, and whether there are, in fact, legal consequences for Israel, as we see featured in the very title of the opinion?
Jan, it's an advisory opinion, but it's advice asked for by the UN, and it's a comprehensive summary of legal conclusions that have been in place for, 60 years now. But it really organizes them and presents them in a way more thorough and complete than ever before. It basically holds that occupation, as you said, is illegal, and it must end. It's an occupation of Palestinian land, including the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. And not only does it call for an end to the occupation, but it calls for reparations for the Palestinians who've lived under Israel's occupation since it began in 1967. It declares Israel's mistreatment of Palestinians to be a form of segregation and apartheid. And it further ruled that nations like the U.S. cannot offer aid and support of these illegal occupations without violating international law.
That would be something I'd like to hear you say more about in a bit. But one aspect of the opinion that I found particularly of historical importance is that the court rejected the notion that Palestinian self-determination must be achieved solely through bilateral negotiations with Israel. And they added that this requirement has, quote, subjected Palestinians to violence, dispossession, and rights violations for 30 years. Can you comment on that aspect of the ruling, which I think is very much a commentary on the history of these so-called peace negotiations?
It reminds me of the law like 120 years ago when the U.S. Supreme Court rejected the idea that workers could organize and rejected unions in different contexts because it said it violated the sacred right of contracts between two equals, Union Pacific Railroad and a worker named Joe Schmo. The idea that there's equality here and that we need to lead these two parties resolve their own disputes ignores reality, which is that Israel is not only far more prosperous, but it has the support of the United States in every way and is effectively an extension of the U.S. in terms of many policies it maintains. There's nothing resembling two equal parties sitting down in a room trying to hash out their differences. It's not like that.
And has dominion militarily, economically, and politically over all of those territories from the river to the sea.
Well, that's a big basis of the opinion. The laws it relies on are the Geneva Convention, regular international law, previous UN resolutions, and it looked at the whole prolonged occupation. It looked at the transfer of civilian population. It looked at the confiscation of land, the exploitation of natural resources. It looked at how Israeli law has extended to all these areas. It looked at the forced displacement of Palestinian populations en masse. It looked at all the violence against Palestinians and concluded that it was illegal, profoundly illegal, and cited several precedents. For each of these activities by Israel is explicitly banned by international law, and yet each one of them has been carried out more or less for the entire 60-year period.
And the court also said that Israel has an obligation to pay restitution for harm and, quote, the evacuation of all settlers from existing settlements. That's a tall order, because settlements is, I think, most people who follow the news around this and the genocide in Gaza and all of the oppression on the West Bank know that these settlements have extended and kind of strangled any Palestinian habitats, farming houses in the entire West Bank.
That's the whole point of putting those settlers there, is making it the reality on the ground is that this is now occupied by Israel. That's why Israel's devoted a huge amount of its state, and they're now financially in great peril because the present financial minister is an absolute far-right, deep believer in the miraculous regime of Judea and Samaria, and he's funneling all the money that the state has over to these settlers and these settlements.
So that is part of a colonial model, and some have argued that Israel's the last of the colonial projects that has also the support of much of the West, including, of course, the United States. But settlements, outposts of this sort, are part of the colonial project.
Well, that's what makes this opinion particularly valuable. It is, as they say, an advisory opinion. The International Court of Justice does not have any army to enforce its rulings, but it does legitimize all the Western governments that have recognized Palestine as a separate state, and it legitimizes the movement to boycott and divest from Israel. It legitimizes opposition to the whole colonial project in all its many forms.
So the U.S. predictably responded that it was, quote, strongly discouraged by the ruling, and that it discourages parties from continuing with negotiations around the ceasefire. I mean, that, of course, is predictable. It's a little softer than Israel's just flagrant dismissal of this and other rulings by the international courts, charging everyone with anti-Semitism, like the pattern of McCarthyism, where everyone becomes a communist. The weight of McCarthyism, the force of it falls under the weight of its expanded accusations. Now, every criticism, including the courts, is dismissed by Israeli officials as anti-Semitic.
They go beyond that, Jan. The response now shows the fractures within Israel, because the government immediately dismissed the ICJ ruling. Netanyahu called Jerusalem our eternal capital, and he referred to the West Bank as the land of our ancestors, he referred to it as Judea and Samaria. So we're seeing the kind of secular, semi-democratic Israel that we've known is gradually morphing at an accelerated pace, certainly since October 7th, into a state of fundamentalist religiosity. And you know, 500,000 people in Israel have left since October 7th. And those 500,000 people are generally prosperous, capable people. It's not easy to migrate to another country. That would be the equivalent of 15 million or 20 million people leaving the United States. Israel is seriously fractured by this split between the old timers and the new timers. And
they've lost the narrative that's been so central to liberal Zionism in the U.S. and other places in the West, that exactly. Israel, with all its faults and problems, is a kind of beacon of democracy in the Middle East. And if you continue with the peace negotiations, that these problems can be solved within the framework of Israel as a Judeo-nationalist project. So there's a lot of debate about what kinds of reforms, what kinds of changes would be required, I mean, to really achieve any form of meaningful democracy in Israel and justice for Palestinians. But the rulings or the opinions of the court seem to require quite a bit, and it's a heavy lift for Israel to meet the demands of the moment. What do you think the consequences of this or the effects of this ruling are?
I think it goes a long way toward delegitimizing Israel as it's presently constituted. It does so comprehensively. It relates to all kinds of international law that is binding in a variety of contexts, economically, in every way, politically, criminal law. It's all there, and it's all comprehensively put, and it's all very emphatic. And the fact that it is, as you say, a heavy lift to undo all the occupation underlines how deeply penetrating Israel's occupation is. And I think it helps toward defining that as a massive illegality. And even as Israel slides in its international recognition toward being perceived as a state like all the other Middle Eastern states of religious fundamentalists, I think this opinion will show how profoundly illegal are its actions and how much they fly in the teeth of what has become known as a rules-based society. It's a term favored by the U.S. The actual rules that govern a rules-based society are being flagrantly violated by Israel in this occupation. And this opinion articulates exactly how that is, when it happened, and where it's happening.
You know, the BDS movement, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement in the U.S., it's been around for at least 20 years and has struggled, but has been revived and expanded since October 7th, and also been made illegal in many states. So BDS demands on the part of students and faculty and organizations in the U.S. are confronting now the threat of losing critical funds if they support BDS aims. Yet this ruling actually calls for breaking or reviewing diplomatic, political, and economic ties with Israel, inclusive of business and finance, pension funds, academia, and charities.
Exactly. It not only legitimizes the BDS movement, it requires it.
Yes. Instead,
no, this is the only way to respond. In fact,
why isn't this headlines in the New York Times?
It basically says if you don't comply with BDS, you are effectively supporting illegalities, and you therefore become a part of that illegality.
So do you think activists around the country, including in academia, where the effects of this are quite severe, and are curtailing efforts to call at their universities to meet BDS demands, do you think this ICJ ruling could be of help to activists?
Absolutely. That's the area where it will help the most, because that's the area supposedly governed by rules. That's the area where the laws that are established are supposed to be upheld. So it's true, there are various southern states have made it illegal, but the international law, a law recognized by 150 countries, is completely on the side, or rather is sort of summarized and articulated by this opinion. And that's a heavy chip to have in your, they did not exist. For this upcoming academic year, this opinion will be, I predict, invaluable. It'll be used by different people in different contexts to help support all sorts of resistance to the Zionist domination of the faculties, the institutions, and the customs to be followed in all the universities. We'll see what happens when students return this academic year.
Okay, we'll be following that closely. Thanks, Mike. This is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking today about the International Court of Justice ruling in July on Israel's occupation of Gaza and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and its declaration that this is unlawful, as well as the importance of that opinion and the details of that opinion for justice in Palestine organizing. And Mike, I encourage people to read. It's great reading to go online. It's a long read, but you just see the detailed legal and scholarly work behind the opinions of the court. So we'll continue to follow this.
Can't you hear the urgent call of Palestine? Can't you hear the urgent call of Palestine? Palestine. Can't you hear the urgent call of Palestine? Can't you hear the urgent call of Palestine? Palestine. Tormented, tortured, bruised and battered, and all her sons and daughters scattered. Can't you hear the sweet sad voice of
During Israel's invasion of Lebanon, the IDF seized the master copy of Zainab Schott's The Urgent Call of Palestine. Now, more than 40 years later, the song has been reissued, and you just heard a clip from it. Before that, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discussed the implications of the International Court of Justice ruling that establishes the illegality of Israeli actions in the Middle East. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, and I'm Patricia Kohlberg, your host. Is KBOO part of your life? Do you regularly tune in to 90.7 for music, news, local happenings, or perspectives you won't hear on commercial radio? Then please help keep your local, non-commercial radio station on the air by contributing to our fall fun drive, Waking Up the Neighborhood. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by sending a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Thank you so much for your support. On August 14, The Guardian reported that 19 national heat records have been broken so far this year, and that's an unprecedented number. 3 days before that, The New York Times reported that global warming could, quote, trigger sweeping changes in the natural world that would be hard, if not impossible, to reverse. The examples they cited included the bleaching of the great coral reefs, deforestation in the Amazon rainforest, thawing of the permafrost, collapse of the rotating currents of the Atlantic Ocean, and others. We have precious little time to do what it would take to prevent climate catastrophe of unimaginable proportions. And it might be reasonable to ask, is it even possible? Economist Marty Hart Landsberg argues, yes, it's possible, but not with the approach global leaders are taking today. Marty Hart Landsberg is professor emeritus of economics at Lewis and Clark College. He is the author of 7 books on issues related to globalization and the political economy of East Asia, and numerous journal articles. He is the chair of Portland Rising, a committee of Portland Jobs with Justice, and chair of the Oregon chapter of the National Writers Union. He blogs at Reports from the Economic Front. Marty is here with me today to talk about capitalism and climate change, which he recently wrote about in his blog. Marty Hart Landsberg, welcome to KBOO and to the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you. I'm really pleased to be here with you.
It's generally believed that market forces can be harnessed to control carbon emissions, specifically by moving energy production away from fossil fuels to renewables. Now, in your blog, you argued that market forces aren't working and will not work to affect the changes that we need to make. I'd like to start by asking you about market forces. What do you mean by that? And maybe you could give us some examples of what the Biden administration has been pursuing in order to harness these forces.
So at the heart of the Biden administration has been a reliance on market forces. And what the government hopes to do is to nudge them and get them going. And so it's done that by some tax benefits, some regulatory benefits, and underlying it is the belief that when renewable energy sources get cheap enough, the industry is going to shift on its own, and it will become a self-reinforcing process where renewables power our electricity and increasingly our economy. Unfortunately, it's been about 5 years since that change happened, where renewables, solar and wind, have become cheaper than fossil fuels.
And it didn't work.
Well, there's been much more production of renewable energy, but it hasn't led to the reduction of fossil fuel production. And fossil fuel production is what's adding to global warming. So, for example, if you look at just electricity production, the core of it, over 40%, is natural gas. Coal, after it declined for a while, has now stabilized at a pretty high level, 16%, more than solar and wind together. So what we have is the market has cheapened renewables, and there's more production of them, but they're not replacing fossil fuels. They're just helping to add more energy to meet the demand that's growing.
Well, is that because there just isn't enough of the renewables, or is there something else going on?
The core thing, and what the market analysts say, and the evidence seems very clear, is that the profits to be made in fossil fuel production are double, at least, sometimes triple, the profits to be made for setting up wind farms or solar farms. So the fossil fuel companies are saying it's not worth our effort, it's not responsible to our stockholders to cut our fossil fuel production to go into solar or wind. And as to the reason why that's the case, I mean, there's lots of debates about that, but the market restrictions in fossil fuel production are pretty great. It's hard to just sort of jump in and become a fossil fuel firm. It's relatively easy to try and come in and set up a solar farm or a wind farm, and it's relatively easy to get into the market. And so the banks aren't willing to lend money to these renewable producers because they're really unsure about what's going to happen. So they're lending some, but not a lot, and we're not getting the huge increase. And the fossil fuel companies, who are making 10 to 15% returns, are saying, we don't want to take our money and go into an industry that's only making 5 to 6% returns. So the market is saying, keep going, keep producing fossil fuels. And even though we're getting more renewables, they're not replacing fossil fuels. So that's one example where we rely on the market and there's some adjustment, but it's not significant enough. I'll just give one other example. And that is, a couple years back, the savior was going to be ESG investing. ESG stood for environment, social, and employment. And the idea was that the financial markets were going to set up these funds. So if you wanted to invest with Vanguard or BlackRock or State Street, you can put your money in an ESG fund, and they'll be so attractive and that eventually all the funding will go to companies that are best practice, environment, and so on and so forth. And that's going to lead the economy through the market to reward fund companies who are doing the right thing, protecting the environment. The problem was that who decides what's an ESG fund? Well, they're private rating companies, and they make up their own rating. So they would look at ExxonMobil and say, oh, they're doing a great job because they're going paper in their office. I mean, they're getting rid of paper in their office. So isn't that's great environment? Or they issued, don't fly quite as much to your corporate meetings, Zoom occasionally. And so as a result, all the oil companies and fossil fuel companies remained in the ESG funds. The rating companies liked it because they were getting paid to rate. The companies themselves liked it because they didn't have to change their practices. And Vanguard and the others liked it because they charged people more for managing their money in an ESG fund. So again, look into the market, what happens? Nothing. There are lots of examples like this where we say the market will handle it, will provide a vehicle for investors or companies. And what happens is we continue to pump out fossil fuels.
So it sounds like the stick of climate change simply is no match for the profit motive.
I think that's fair to say. It's not to say that there aren't some changes, but they're not sufficient. And I guess this is really one of the most important parts, which is that when we continue to use fossil fuels, we pump out greenhouse gases, and they can remain in the atmosphere for 100 to 1,000 years. So every time we say, we'll wait for this to happen, we're pumping more of these greenhouse gases, which means, and what the climate scientists say are that as the concentrations grow, it can take up to a decade to see the higher temperatures. Every year we wait and rely on markets, which have proven not to be sufficient, we're locking in an environment that's going to be more and more inhabitable for us.
So short of the overthrow of capitalism, which presents its own challenges, what might we do that does not involve market forces toward reducing emissions?
I think one of the things we need to realize is that even though we can do a better job of boosting solar and wind power, we can't replace fossil fuels one for one. We've got to think about reducing our overall energy use, because renewables still require certain rare earth metals. They're limited supply. They have to be taken out of the ground, which has its environmental consequences for many countries in the global south. So it's not just boost those up and keep the energy going. We have to figure out a way to reduce our overall energy use and make the transformation. So we've got to dramatically reduce fossil fuels. We have to increase renewables, but it's not going to be one-to-one. We have to reduce our energy use. So how do we do that in ways that protect the quality of life for most people? And again, it's not that hard to think about it. We need to reduce the production of single-family mansions, of giant sports utility vehicles, of private jets, of luxury cruises, of single-use, you know, products. And also the U.S. military. The U.S. military is the largest greenhouse gas producer in the world. If you start reducing those things, you reduce the amount of energy use. And as you start to increase renewables, you begin to get a surplus of energy that can be directed towards things we really want, like universal health care and better mass transit system and public housing programs and regenerative agriculture. These things sound like they're services, but they come with a lot of job creation. If you build a new healthcare system, you need new clinics, construction. You need things in those clinics, new x-ray machines. You need new vehicles. You need new education systems. If you have electrified, you know, rail, you need to redesign your locomotives. You need to redesign the rail. So there's a lot of job creation that will create an economy that meets people's needs. So the question is, how do you get to that?
That's what I'm wondering. People are not going to give up their SUVs and their McMansions.
They certainly don't want to give it away. I think there are a lot of people who would be willing to say, well, we should stop producing them. But how do we do that? I mean, we've lived so long under a kind of a free market capitalist world that we can't even imagine what a transformation would look like to produce a different economy. And, you know, it's challenging because you need to build new industries. You need to expand some existing ones. You need to repress and shut down yet other ones. You need to figure out how to move raw materials around. A whole lot of things, a lot of moving parts. And so it becomes almost overwhelming. And here's where I think history can be very helpful. If you look back to World War II, when the U.S. converted its economy from civilian to military, there are a lot of lessons that can be learned that demonstrate it is not a magic trick to plan and restructure an economy. We've done it, although back then it was a little bit different challenges than now. They're not as different as one might think. And it's very suggestive of the kinds of things we need to do now and to see that they're doable. It's not something that's unimaginable if we start to get serious about rejecting free market solutions and think about the kind of capacities we need to build.
Well, before you talk about more specifics, during World War II, we really had a very clear and present danger. They talk about tipping points, but maybe there's a different tipping point that mm-hmm. we need to take even more seriously, is at what point does the public consciousness of thinking of climate change as a clear and present danger and we need to do something now? And how do we precipitate that change in attitude? Because right now, I don't think the American public is ready for the kind of command economy that it took to make all those changes during World War II.
I mean, you lay out the challenge really well. Let me respond in a couple ways. One is, there's kind of this image that when we hit World War II, we all rolled up our sleeves and we said, let's get it done. And one of the things that's similar to the challenge then, to the challenge we face now, is that U.S. business opposed the restructuring of the economy to fight World War II. They refused to invest. For example, when the U.S. government said, we need more steel and aluminum, U.S. business said, we're not going to invest to produce more. How do we know how long the war is going to go? How do we know we're going to win? So they literally would not invest. There were companies like the auto industry that were gobbling up all the resources. And the government said, we need these resources for the military. The auto industry said, it's too profitable. Markets are expanding. We're not going to do that. So the restructuring didn't happen because business said, this is a good idea. And if they're not willing to do that in a war, which is, as you say, this is really critical, I don't expect them to do it in this climate crisis where they're making profits. But if people come to understand that a change in structure and system is possible, then the climate crisis becomes different. Because right now, the way the climate crisis appears to people is do with less and nothing else, right? We're going to cut fossil fuels. So what happens to people who work in the auto industry or in the aircraft industry or the tourist industry? So unless we begin to show and gain confidence that economies, whole systems can be changed to produce a better way of life that's more stable, then people say, yeah, it gets hotter. Maybe I'll use air conditioning more. Maybe I'll just suffer more. But what other choice do I have? Right now, the choice doesn't seem real to people. And so that's where I think the World War II understandings make it possible for people to see this isn't rocket science. You can begin to change an economy. And yes, even then, big business opposed it. So of course they're going to oppose it now. But we didn't accept their opposition then. We don't need to accept their opposition now.
So a big part of that is visioning,
yes.
Making something seem possible.
Yes. And so that's where I think, you know, when we fight for an environment that's livable, we need to make sure that our messaging includes, we can't expect, you know, markets to solve the problem. We have to begin to think about planning possibilities. And there are ways of building capacities. For example, the UE, United Electrical Workers, are in the midst of a smart locomotive campaign. Their unions are trying to force locomotive producers to create locomotives that run on batteries that don't pollute. And they're trying to work with environmentalists and government to get that, and environmentalists and government to get the railroads to buy those locomotives. So we need to begin thinking about capacities for planning. Those are big conversations, but that's where the conversation has to go. We have to start developing the confidence that we can do things. So if you look at World War II, we didn't get this transformation magically. It was big government spending on the military. It went from about 2% of GDP in 1940 to almost 40% by 1944. That last year, government spending on the military accounted for half of all the goods produced. Imagine that kind of transformation. Now, how did you get the production? Private investment in 1944 was 37% of the level it was in 1940. They had stopped investing. So what the government did is it created something called the Defense Production Corporation and said, you have an unlimited checkbook. You decide what industries we need, and you go out and you build them and you own them and you can have a private company manage them. And so the Defense Production Corporation accounted for over 30% of all the investment in the United States during the war. And when the war ended, it owned about 20% of all the new factories that were built in the United States. These were all publicly owned, financed by the U.S. government. So about 70% of all the new capacity was government investment. They didn't wait for the private sector. And as a last part, they didn't just say, let's invest. They also planned the economy, because when the military kept saying, we want this and we want that, it created this kind of feeding frenzy for things. So the government came in and said, no, we're going to look at all the key minerals and metals, all the key components, and we're going to plan who gets them. You submit plans to us, what you need. We'll decide which firms will get steel now, which will get aluminum then, which will get machine tools now. They did all that. And as a consequence, the U.S. economy began to run very efficiently, switched gears. Part of the planning was not just build up the military, but they said no more auto production, no more tire production. They essentially planned which industries would shrink because non-military production went down. So the long and short of this is, against the desires of big corporations, we developed planning agencies that went through a series of improvements that allowed us to run an economy, transform that economy, and produce the goods and services we needed to fight the war. If we understand those things, we can start to say, well, if we're going to cut fossil fuels and we want to repress certain industries, how do we make sure that new ones grow, not wait for the market to decide we need these things, but government investment can do it? It's a problem to be studied and a movement to be built for change.
And a big job here that we have is transmitting that vision, making that vision real, elevating examples. Yeah, like you said, waiting for there to be some sort of natural drift. It's just not going to happen.
This is where I think environmentalists and labor needs to start talking. Mm. Because again, if you go back to World War II, the UE, for example, towards the end of the war, had a series of conferences in the Midwest where they would invite two people from every department and every firm they owned, represented, African-American leaders, religious leaders, to talk about what would planning look like at the end of the war to maintain full employment. And they came up with programs, how to organize whole industries. And so what we need to do is the environmental movement, the housing movement, the labor movement need to start talking about how do we ensure that we have a vision of, like you said before, of an economy that works for us, that's going to be survivable and livable. And let's study some of these lessons and let's talk about what skills we might have now and what capacities.
Well, we are out of time. So could you tell our listeners, Marty, where they can find your blog?
Sure. If you just Google reports from the economic front, it will pop up and you will see on the blog a sub-tab for publications. And if you click on that, you can tell by the title, a number of articles there on planning experience and its contemporary relevance, some of the efforts that unions made back then to think about what a worker-centered planning would look like, the challenges, as you pointed out so well, of building the kind of movement we need.
Thank you very much, Marty Hart-Landsberg, for joining me today. We'll have you on again sometime.
Well, I appreciate it. Your audience is a good audience to talk with, so thank you for having me.
You got to accentuate the positive feeling. Mind it to negative, latch on to the affirmative. Don't mess with Mr. In-Between. You got to spread joy up to the maximum. Bring gloom down to the minimum. Have faith or pandemonium, liable to walk upon the scene.
To illustrate, his last remark, Jonah in the whale, Noah in the ark.
You just heard a bit of the World War II era song by Bing Crosby titled Accentuate the Positive. Before that, I was speaking to Marty Hart Landsberg about harnessing the economy through central planning to achieve a rapid transition to renewable energy sources. KBOO is people-powered radio. We're on the air not to make a buck, but to make a difference. If that matters to you, then please consider making a donation today to support our fall fund drive and keep KBOO going strong. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by sending a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. Oregon's Climate Protection Program, a plan to reduce carbon emissions from major polluters, has been under assault from the fossil fuel industry since its inception. Right now, DEQ is holding hearings to finalize the rules of the long-delayed implementation of the program, and Northwest Natural Gas is leading the charge to further gut the program. Jen Hawkins speaks with climate justice activist Diana Meisenhelter about what's at stake and how you can do your part to protect or even improve our climate protection program. Diana Meisenhelter has been an environmental and social justice activist, labor organizer, and educator for over 50 years, and is on the global, national, and local teams of Extinction Rebellion, a global climate justice organization.
Welcome to KBOO and the Old Mole Variety Hour, Diana Meisenhelter.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, you've been on the Old Mole before to talk about environmental justice activism, and we appreciate you having you on today to talk about the climate protection program in Oregon, and why this is something we need to be organizing around. So let's start by having you just describe the climate protection program and why it's important.
Yeah, well, the Oregon Climate Protection Program aims to reduce like 90% of harmful emissions from the state's largest polluters by 2050. And the implementation of it was delayed for 3 years on a technicality following a suit by oil and gas companies, including Northwest Natural Gas. And the corporations are still attempting to weaken and reduce pollution penalties and delay the new revised CPP program, which is why it's really important for people to know about this and to make their voices heard. The community investment projects funded by holding accountable the largest state polluters through community climate investment credits are critical to community climate resiliency, and they themselves will also reduce emissions by funding nonprofits that are going to do weatherization and heat pumps and solar energy, things like that, for marginalized communities. CCI funding will bring justice to frontline communities who are already being affected by devastating climate-fueled extreme weather and public health and safety risks. And the deadline for the testimony has just been extended to September 27th. And there's also going to be a virtual hearing on September 26th. There was one last night that many of us participated in.
2050 is a long time down the road. And hasn't that been a strategy of a lot of these clean energy initiatives to have the goal be so far down the road that it's hard to measure progress toward it? Or, you know, people might say we're all going to be doomed by then anyway. This is like 26 years from now.
So the good news is it has ongoing targets for each of the years, and it's being monitored each year. It's monitoring the reductions. Every 2 years, there's a whole big implementation compliance period. And
the Department of Environmental Quality, DEQ.
Yeah. And we're asking actually that in the first year, because of all these delays, that they do a 1 year compliance period. And then after that, do 2 years. But we'll be able to track the emissions reductions every 2 years, and also the reductions that are happening from the climate, the community climate investment credits. Credits kick in when polluters don't meet the reduction goals, and they have this option and many other options as well to purchase the credits if they aren't able to reduce their pollution.
Credits are known to be a kind of corrupt and not very effective form of greenwashing, where you pay for the right to pollute or shuffle things around. That seems like a red flag, the whole...
Yeah, and normally I would agree. I usually have a lot of problems with the kind of offset models are pretty horrible. And indeed, that's what the utility companies are still calling for, is like offsets or RFPs. But this is totally different. One, it's way more expensive if they don't reduce their pollution, instead of like the, and this is why the utility companies and big polluters are screaming, is that instead of it being like $20 a ton or something like that, this is like $129 a ton. And secondly, this is going directly back into local projects that benefit the most marginalized communities.
The fines that are generated.
Yes, if they don't go ahead and meet the goals, you know, this is a higher incentive to be able to meet those goals than any of those other kinds of offsets are doing, which is why the biggest polluters are screaming about it. And they were very vocal yesterday, but fortunately we outnumbered them.
Before you continue, can you say a little more about the science-based criteria? Because I know that's been a big part of the work that you do through Extinction Rebellion, emphasizing science for the people and science-based recognition of the climate crisis. And that's an emphasis in the organizing around the climate action plan. I mean, the climate protection program. What can you say a bit about how we view science? Because, of course, these companies have their own hired hands, including many universities, that produce findings that support their claims.
Yeah, well, the world's best climate scientists have put out policies basically every year. They say what the goals need to be and how much we need to do. For instance, we need to have cut emissions by 50% by 2030. In order to avoid the worst unthinkable consequences. And we've already blown past the global warming standards that they had in place. And so those are very conservative at this point, recommendations. And yet, basically, the strategy, corporate delay, is kind of the new climate denial. They basically are out there trying to like push everything back in time, and we can't afford to do that anymore. And
well, so how does organizing around this climate protection program align with the scientific evidence that we need to move much more quickly?
Well, there was a lot of heartfelt testimony last night about what we're already seeing, both here in Oregon, where we're seeing, if you look at the fire map for Oregon this summer, it's aflame all over. If you look at the state map, there's millions of acres being destroyed by forest fires right as we speak. And we have it easy. I work with Global Extinction Rebellion. And in other parts of the world right now, it's just unthinkable what is happening. So this is well underway. And that's why trying to stay focused on the kind of science-based emissions reductions and not like try and in any way wiggle room our way out of that or delay. That's unacceptable at this point in time, given the place that we're at within this crisis. And so one of the other things that we're asking is that they're whining about the pricing structure and trying to attack falsely. In fact, there were articles both in the Oregonian and the Capital Chronicle this last week talking about how they falsely, like Northwest Natural Gas, sent out a customer newsletter in their billing thing where they attacked the climate protection program and attacked the cost, attacked the community climate investment credits. And we say we need to uphold that pricing structure and the equity provisions of those credits because, you know, they themselves are going to do amazing things to reduce emissions in addition to incentivizing the companies that they have to be reducing emissions on a timeline in line with state goals. I mean, it's sort of insane that they would attack these programs that are going to reduce emissions, create jobs, protect our community health, mitigate against climate chaos, and provide critical environmental justice investments to Oregon's most vulnerable communities.
Diana, before we close, can you let listeners know how they can get involved? Say a little about that and where people can turn for more information.
Okay, well, a simple way to get details on testifying in support of the improvements to the Climate Protection Program, along with the talking points, can be found by Googling xrpdx.org and then going to the Take Action tab and scrolling down to the article on the CPP. The deadline's just been extended to September 27th, and there's going to be another public hearing on the 26th. And hopefully you can get an updated Zoom to that meeting at that site. Or if not, you can Google the Oregon Climate Protection Program and it'll pop up. The DEQ information will pop up along with all the background information about the Oregon Climate Protection Program. But it's just really important that people take action because corporations are organizing and they've, you know, gotten conservative government folks to take stances that are crazy. They want to say it can't be done there. It has to go back to the legislature. But we all know what they do at the legislature. They bring in their big paid lobbyists and then they walk out. They have the conservative, you know, Republican folks walk out so nothing can happen there. And so it's really important to push this forward, support it, but make the improvements that will make it what it needs to be.
It's an ongoing struggle, but we have a lot on our side to fight these empty suits. Well, hopefully we'll see you on the streets. Extinction Rebellion is known for its creative tactics and its multiple tactics. So
we were outside of Northwest Natural Gas's headquarters doing skits yesterday, leafleting everybody.
Thanks so much, Diana Meisenhelder, for having you on the show today. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Jan.
That was Jan Hawkins speaking to Diana Meisenhelder about critical rulemaking for Oregon's Climate Protection Program. Info about how to attend the September 26 DEQ hearing and submit testimony is posted on the page for this segment at kboo.fm. That's a wrap for our show. Thanks to Moles, Jan Hawkins, and Mike Snedeker for their contributions. A special thanks to our guests, Marty Hart-Landsberg and Diana Meisenhelder. And as always, a shout out to the staff at KBOO. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the hour. KBOO is proud to be one of the longest-lived community radio stations in the country, and it's only through the ongoing support of listeners that KBOO continues to thrive. Be part of the community and show your support by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by sending a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And a big thanks to all of you who have given so generously in the past. I'm going to leave you today with a bit more of Paul McCartney's song, Despite Repeated Warnings. Thanks for listening, and catch us again next Monday morning.
Hi, this is Mark Sanford Gross, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.